Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. We're just two aunties sharing our experience through the lens of one Blackfoot woman and one Anishinaabe woman. And we are Indigenous Vision, an educational nonprofit based in Montana and Arizona. We are 100% Indigenous-led, and this is our podcast. Check us out at indigenousvision.org to learn more about our work, make a donation, or play back any of our radio shows and this episode.
Hey, welcome to the Indigenous Vision Podcast. You are officially listening to episode 107. We are so glad to have you back. My name is Melissa Spence. I'm coming to you from Las Vegas, Nevada, and we've got our executive director, Suta Collinglast, on the other side, who is in Montana. How are you, Suta?
I'm doing really good. I know, Montucky. It's cold here. We finally have snow, but not that much snow. It's still a light dusting on the ground and there's going to be more coming in. And so no traveling really, it's like joyful, extended driving, traveling, but I'm healthy again, which is good. I had one of those colds that it was like a bronchial and then sinus. And then it turned into this migraine, which was one of those like dizzying kind of things. And so I had like a really rough couple of days where like all of those little things coincided and then I got through it. And I had almost wanted to quit on some of like the big, well, not quit, but because I don't know if I can, but I was starting to get fatigued, you know, and some of the deadlines had already passed. And so I'm like, project officer, I don't know if I can make it. And she's like, I'm going to ignore that. You've got one more day of work left on this.
I'm like, wow. Okay,
I can do this. I can do it. And so I'm going to sit down and have a little writing retreat this weekend for myself and unplug and see if I could just finish this one document so that I can move on to the other documents I'm working on. It's all exciting work. It's just writing is one of the biggest challenges for me. I feel like it has to do, it's not artistic. It's not, I don't know if I tap into that creative spot, but once I get going and it's something I'm really passionate about, I can write a lot on it. It's just, I think that's where my imposter syndrome and trauma has come in a lot, is like a lot of the tearing me down has been on my literacy. And so I get really self-conscious about it and it tends to come out there. So
I'm so surprised to hear that because your writing is fabulous. Like even your Facebook posts are amazing. I don't get it.
I know. Isn't that funny? But it's like, you know, mean boyfriends, the things they say stick with you. Yeah. So fighting through that. Yes.
I'm glad to hear you're going to make yourself a little retreat over the weekend, because I just had a retreat and it was so amazing to just unplug and not really worry about what everyone else is doing for at least 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. And the Joshua trees. I love being amongst the Joshua trees. They're so different. It's such a different place
so
in this
different.
World.
Yeah. Even the shade they give. I remember when we were packing up and I was standing under one because it was kind of warm during the day here in, you know, the Southwest. And the type of shade it provided was also very unique. It was like a really solid form of shade. And I just thought of all the generations of people who have laid underneath them as a relief from the desert heat and just how powerful they are. I learned their real names from different tribes. I guess the English translation from what they would be called in the other, from other nations like Shoshone, would be desert dagger because of, you know, their spikes. And I did run into one with my hairdo and I was like, whoa, it really is a desert dagger. So Joshua Tree is kind of its colonial name, unfortunately, but they've been here for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the average age of them is like 150 years old in the Joshua Tree area. So it was really like a lot to contemplate and reflect on, like sitting there looking at them and just all the history they have and what's going on inside of them and how mysterious they kind of are to me. And just to see them both during the day and during nighttime while we're stargazing was just so spectacular. So a retreat, I highly recommend. You never know, you could go off on like a huge writing tangent and like finish maybe more than one project over the weekend. You never know.
Right. And we just got a really fabulous grant and we're looking for more money to kind of cushion it to plan a retreat for all of the MMIW providers and support networks, transporters, self-defense instructors. If you're a woman in the community working in MMIW in any capacity, we have a retreat coming up. It's the first weekend of April, 1 month before our May 5th events. And this is to hopefully rejuvenate you. If you're a community organizer, like how we have been community organizers, like that 1 month before the event is like the hardest time that we have, because everything starts to get down to the wire. Everything needs to be paid. Everything needs to be put together. The agenda needs to be in the right order. All of your speakers need to be there. So it's a really stressful time. And I think over the 20, 25 years in community organizing, I've seen a lot of people burn out and succumb to serious and chronic health illnesses. I just know that there's a better way to help people. And it's that old saying of you can't help anybody if you don't help yourself, or that one saying of, are we even capable of loving another person if we don't love ourselves? Like that saying, it seems like a really dumb and silly saying, right? But then you start thinking on it and you get really deep with it. Like, do you love yourself enough to share that overabundance with the community, right? If your cup is full, then you can continue on. If it's not full, definitely that's when we use some of these culture humility rules, right? And we step back, sit back, and just let another sister stand up there for a while. You know, it's not a permanent step back, but it's something that's temporarily that you need to be aware of your own energy and your own inputs so that you can take care of yourself. And it's not quitting. It's not quitting. I've stepped back a lot in my career just because I know my limits, my emotional capacity, my physical capacity. And then when that starts to impact me in terms of like migraines happening and then a series of colds. And yeah, so I've learned the hard way on how to step back. And now I'm trying to turn around and say, hey, little sister, or hey, fellow worker, we need to take better care of ourselves, because it's a certain kind of person that steps up in the community to take care of others and then to run these things. And you really do end up paying from your own pocket for a lot of things and then using way more energy than you thought you would need. So,
yeah, I genuinely feel concerned for some of these younger people who are organizing on the grassroots level and doing a lot of heavy work from the heart and from like the mind in general, and then going about life as usual, raising children and still holding down a 9-to-5 while doing all this crazy work, because yeah, it will add up. Your body keeps track of stuff that you're going through, whether you realize it or not. And I love that you said, you know, you got to love yourself before you love other people, because you can't really share what you don't have. And it all ties into cultural humility, because if you're not self-aware, or if you don't know how to self-critique and open up and be open, then you're not going to be able to fully practice cultural humility as well. And that's like our foundational principle, is the lifelong learning of self-reflection and self-critique. Can you really turn towards yourself and get to know yourself on levels that you may have been avoiding or may not have even known existed or were aware of? And that's truly one of my passions. It's been for the past few years, is getting to know myself on all my crazy levels. And I have, and thanks to the pandemic, it kind of like pushed me further into it. And I came out okay like 3 years later, and I fully stand behind our cultural humility trainings. And I think I said this in the last podcast, to at least have one try of it. If you're skeptical, if you're not really sure what it even means, if it just sounds like this woo-woo theory to you, give it a shot for at least a training session, and then you can really decide for yourself whether it's for you or not, because we got to be realistic. Cultural humility might not be for everybody. It's for us for sure. And I would never stand behind something that I truly didn't believe in. So cultural humility, the first principle, is really the key to living, in my opinion, a wonderful life.
Right. Right. And cultural humility, I think, just lends a person a more joyful, peaceful experience. And that's what I'm all about. Like trying to reduce inflammation, trying to reduce chronic pain and chronic illnesses. I'm trying to reduce the amount of like just general cortisol
stress
in life. And so work should not be one of those places where you're going to combat and have and have stressful conversations. Like, work is work, right? That the word in its sense means putting in an effort to get something done. And but it doesn't have to be extra with unnecessary like chaos and conflict or infighting or backbiting or backstabbing, whatever is that? Are those both words?
Biting, backbiting, all the biting.
All the biting, you know, barking and biting or whatever one is worse. But yeah, that's all unnecessary, and it all actually prevents whatever organization or institution you're part of from providing the community you're serving with good services. The community or your clients have no confidence in you to deliver on time or efficiently, and like individual arguments and policies that are just outdated can really have an impact on how you deliver those and then how people are getting along. And so I went to I saw at one of my workplaces all of the employees get fired and out of a department, and they said, "Oh, but you're fine, Suta. You have a degree for what you're doing, and that makes you fine." And in my mind, I thought, well, for now, that makes me fine for now. But they just fired all of my teammates, destroyed any project plans in place, and I have to recollect like these pick up these pieces with no team and figure out how to move on. And so I also resigned and said I was going back to school, and I picked out something because I do have a big care and love for my community. And I thought, well, you know, none of these policies are in place are native designed policies. None of these policies align with Indigenous value systems. None of our ancestors or tribal leaders put these policies in place in ways that they know make healthy communities. These policies are foreign policies that were implemented and I think enforced in the 60s and 70s when the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Reorganization Act were going into place, and tribes were either forced to accept or not be recognized. And so I did recognize that the policies I was working under were outdated, not made by us. And so I went to get a master's in organizational change management. I think my exact certificate is like master's in management, innovative leadership and change management. What I was specifically looking for was like a way to change policies in our institutions and in our organizations, because bad things happen and the people who are concerned and nice are like, we don't know what to do. These are just the way things are. Like, I wish I could do something. You always hear those sentiments, and it's frustrating for me because I'm action oriented and I'm like, well, we're going to do something about it. And I was in a position to do nothing about it. So I went and found change models for institutions and organizations. And one of the classes in my 3-year degree, which was a really intense master's degree, it was a sped up curriculum. And a lot of people knock on the University of Phoenix for the kind of institution it is. It's like you pay for it. It's like privately owned, and it's a remote education, and I found it invaluable. I could not imagine going to get a master's in management with a bunch of 20-year-old, 30-year-old kids who have no experience in business and management. I was working with individuals close to retirement in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, different levels of government, different levels of the Army, of the Navy, of armed forces. A lot of people who were taking the classes were professionals in high-level leadership positions already in their jobs. And so it was really more like I was mentored from my classmates, because I was one of the youngest ones in my little 2-3-year cohort that I went through with these about 15 people. We would have the same class. And for 6 weeks, I found something called cultural humility. And it was kind of blocked in with the cultural competency, cultural sensitivity, diversity, equity, inclusion. And there was just not much written about it. And I really became fond of those concepts because I was like, wow, these concepts of cultural humility, which were not even the Tervalon and Murray Garcia ideas and framework. It was just like kind of these little ideas and upwellings of ideas across the nation and the world where people are like, we need something different. We don't need sensitivity for other people's culture. I don't need anybody to be sensitive to my culture. You know, I'm strong. I have thick skin. Yeah, I'm not that sensitive. And I don't expect people to know all about everything, you know, so I'm not looking to be offended. I don't need affirmative action. What this world needs is more kindness and more compassion and more abrupt stops on the assumptions that we make about each other, right? If we don't know that something is not true, or we read something or look at a picture and we make a judgment based on how I dress is a really good one. I kind of dress in plain clothes usually. I don't usually like brands. I have become more accustomed to like the alpine clothes being protected from the elements and water wicking materials, like keeping you safe and dry. I am getting fond of those, but traditionally, it's an all black basic format, right? I rely a lot on classic materials, wools, leathers, silks, just basic materials. I try to stay away from yoga pants and sweatpants, and I like tailored. And so I've always been a kid I used to put together pantry bags at our church. We were so poor when we were little. We were under $300 before bills. And so I went to shop the church pantry for a lot of my clothes, and I would put together these fabulous clothes and outfits from donations. And it's just something that has stuck with me because it's also a teaching on my grandpa's side of, it doesn't matter how poor you are, you wash those clothes, make sure they're well kept and mended, and you put your shoulders back and you walk like $1 million. And so those are the teachings I was raised with. And so throughout my life, I've always been assumed that I was like one or like a class level above what I am because of the way I present myself. And so I always get like the, oh, you can afford this assumption sometimes, or you can loan me money. And I'm like, no, I'm wearing a $25 outfit with 15-year-old boots. Like you do, it looks expensive, but thank you. You know, assumptions that we carry about other people really impacts the relationship we have with them and how we treat them, and then how you carry yourselves. And so like when you're abused a lot over your life and you're told your writing is crap, you can't form a thought, you can't form a sentence. Yes, I'm going to write elaborate things, and I'm still going to have those hesitations in the back of my mind. And so similarly, as an individual, like you look like crap. Oh, you can never fit that. You can never wear that. Oh, that's not your style, or that this and that. Like, people will start fitting into those assumptions and accusations about them, I feel like sometimes. And that's when we let those stereotypes victimize us, right? Well, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. No, it's not that. No, I'm going to dress nice, and people can always assume that I'm much richer than I am. I always thought I should start an Instagram channel on like how to dress when you're dirt poor so that people think you make a cool $60,000 a year. Like, I can do that easily. I love it. I love it. It's one of my talents. I can also decorate a room for like $150 for the same.
You are definitely more thrifty than I. I also get mistaken for being a little bit more fancy. I've been called flamboyant over the years, you know, the way I dress. I refuse to wear denim. I refuse to wear sweaters. Like I just can't do it. So I look really fancy, and people are always like, why are you so dressed up? And then I have to go into my spiel. I'm like, I'm not dressed up. It's just how I look. But again, assumptions are a lot. Like the other day I was driving down the street and I saw a guy walking a dog in a suit, which I don't see too often. And I thought, and then I caught myself and I'm like, okay, what assumptions am I making about this person? Playing the assumption game all by myself. And I just thought he must be a real estate agent on a break, taking his dog for a walk. That was the assumption that I made, right? Yeah. It was like a younger dude in a suit, because as soon as you see somebody in a suit in a place where you don't see other suits, like my assumptions just flew off the handle. But then I simmered down with some cultural humility, you know, basics. And I was like, okay, that was a really cool demonstration for just catching my assumptions in real time, in real life once again. And I thought it was really cool, like how people present themselves can really change how you interact with them out in the real world.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I just told my nephew, because he was doing what a lot of kids are doing these days. And he was like doing the eraser head and like making little scratch marks on his skin. And I'm like, dude, don't do that. People are going to judge you. And it sounds really crappy for me to say that, but the scars you have on your body, just like the tattoos, your hair, your clothes, the condition of those, if it's going to make you angry to walk in someplace and see a scowl on somebody's face, like those are the things that you need to worry about. And that was me as a brown auntie teaching my brown nephew of how to exist in a world that's going to constantly judge him on his appearance. And those extra scratches are going to equal harsher judgment. They're going to assume he's like criminal or something.
I feel that. I got hand tattoos, and that's like the one thing I worried about so much when I first moved to Las Vegas was, can I get like a serving job with tattoos? And then I realized almost everybody here has tattoos.
You're in Vegas.
But in Phoenix, they were just like, oh, you're never going to get a job with those. It was just a totally different dynamic. But I do feel the pressure, the societal pressure of like tattoos, and where I'm from, hand tattoos aren't really the most prestigious of tattoos, but they're more popular nowadays, and it's right. People have really calmed down. And the workplace I work at now, I've been there for 2 years actually this month, and I can't believe it. And I think it's because they've taken some sort of training or designed their hiring process, and just their establishment overall does practice some sort of cultural humility, but it's not really. I think it's more like competence and sensitivity, because it is open and I feel comfortable there. Even with like a bob, there is one bob there, but he's manageable for some reason. It's a really interesting dynamic, but I reflect a lot on this job that I have part-time serving here in Las Vegas, and why I've been there for 2 years, and how it's not a bad place. Like, I don't get in my head about having to go to work and be like, oh, I don't want to go to work. I actually kind of don't mind. And I reflect a lot on how that team has designed that environment that way, so that people like me who come in with like a lot of makeup and big hair and tattoos and a really unique style feels comfortable. Why gay people feel comfortable there? Why all kinds of other people feel comfortable there? And I think it really has to do with the management and how they've just streamed their processes in general, because they are a corporate restaurant chain. Like, these are the people that own the Olive Garden, right? Like, they're big and national, and they make a lot of money, and they've taken the time to really figure out how to make their employees comfortable, so that we're not leaving and being like, oh, this place is trash. You know, it's actually not, for me anyways. And I think that has to do with cultural humility in a sense. And I've been trying to define cultural humility. I know that we've had some people on our Facebook page and on our social media in general kind of confused. When you first glance at the two words, cultural humility, what comes up? I tried to put myself in the position of when I was first introduced to it and what those two words mean. Like, what's the first message your brain fires off when you see the words cultural humility? I immediately think of like ethnic culture and then humility in the sense of my culture, and like blending those two things together. But what I learned was that it's way, way more than that. And it's not just a theory, it's an actual framework. And a lot of people might grasp for a physical tool, but what I've learned over the years of doing this is that I am the tool of the cultural humility framework. And I think that's a mindset and a way to do things that people aren't used to doing. So we thought we'd come together on this podcast and kind of define what cultural humility is for anybody who is genuinely curious. And we've gotten a couple of definitions from some past cohort members to share with you. So maybe we should start with each other, though. What? Yes. How would you define it? If someone came to you, had no idea, and was like, what the heck is cultural humility? What would you tell them?
Well, cultural humility, I would say, is a new way of approaching yourself and an individual that you're working with. And so instead of approaching that individual with assumed cultural traits of their appearance, then you step back and you approach that person with the humility to meet them as a brand new person for the first time. And so humility is accepting the person as they say they are, not as they're presenting themselves, not as they are defined by others, but as they say they are. And so that's humility. And humility is not like humiliation. You know, this, it means a lot to a lot of different people. And I think this is why we ask participants to think about how they would define cultural humility and how they break that down and how they have seen it in their life before, because that's our first hurdle as people coming from different backgrounds, is we have completely different definitions of words. And so there is actually a Native lady, and this is lateral violence, you know, a Native lady hating on us in those comments of saying, you know, if you're going to charge $1,000 for a training, don't call it humility. That's not cool. Like, since when? If we were a Black doctor, that would be perfectly acceptable. If we were white doctors, that would be perfectly acceptable. People are used to, especially with the PhD behind the name, people are used to paying that amount of money because of the assumed expertise, right? The competency that you get with that much training. But we have also put in that much training in ourselves as well. I've put in a lot of education and training and facilitation. And how much training have I put into speaking and facilitation? Thousands and thousands of dollars. And so I consider myself worth the investment of training. And if I see that, you know, some trainings cost $3,000, and those are usually like my organizational management or leadership trainings that I'm finding that are in that range. But these are like kind of mentored trainings or curriculums and models that are designed by subject matter professionals or experts within that field. And I find it very valuable to put that little tidbit into my toolkit of things that I could pull out when I'm facilitating a dialogue and leading a group. And so cultural humility means a lot of things to everybody. And I think it's important you identify what that means to you without it pointing a finger, shaming, or blaming anybody else. Because that's not humility, is it? You can't point a finger at anybody and say it's humble, right?
Yes. I think she was expecting us to be more humble and like lower our prices due to just having that in our title, right? Like cultural humbleness is what I think she thought. But again, I don't think people are used to seeing Indigenous women, you know, leveling up and saying, pay me this much because I'm worth this much.
Well, and then there's a lot of assumptions around the word culture too, especially it's so assumed that if an Indigenous woman says, hey, I have a cultural training, you're going to teach me Indian stuff. No, I'm not. I'm not.
Right.
This is not me teaching you my spirituality. This is not me teaching you the way I pray or how I connect to the earth. This is me teaching you about how I was raised in the contemporary social construct.
And it's rare. It's rare to have two Indigenous women facilitating trainings like this, in my opinion, because I've never come across it in my years searching for training. So I think it's really important and unique. However, I do see how some people could get confused and maybe think that it's traditional teachings that we're going to be relaying to them when it's in fact a framework designed by two Black women, two Black doctors from the Oakland Bay area. And it's completely different. And I don't think people have spent the time to really research what they're checking out on the internet.
So funny, isn't it?
Right?
So hundreds, thousands of assumptions on just the word cultural humility.
People are like, what is this? Why are you charging $1,000?
How dare you? How dare you?
So we decided to put this podcast together to kind of give anybody who's interested a little bit more of a defining, I guess, message of what it could be. And again, it's person by person. If you watch the Vivian Chavez documentary on cultural humility, you'll see that it is literally based on an individual perspective. So my perspective is a little bit different than your perspective. I can read one from Jessica. It doesn't say what cohort she's from, but I have a feeling this is from the January cohort of 2023. So she said, cultural humility is an awareness of ourselves and how we view the world around us. It is knowing that we collectively walk alongside each other, that we are not above or below anyone. We are walking in kindness, humility, and humbleness, asking questions when needed, but in a safe manner. Cultural humility is living a way of life that reflects inherent self-awareness, including empowering a deep, intimate connection with those around us. I like that.
Wow. I like, yeah. And it's not superficial relationships that you're making. It's not the, you know, how we're all trained to say, good morning, how are you? And then most people don't even wait around for you to answer.
Right. I get that all the time at the restaurant. And I just say, I'm fine. Thank you. I never ask back because we're too busy.
Yeah, I know. I'm the person who always like gets shut up because I start saying how I am. And I'm like, oh, they didn't even actually. It was just a greeting, like hi.
Right? It's just an automatic thing, a habit that we do in this society. Hey, how are you? Real quick. And some people don't even wait. They just go into their spiel or whatever it is they want to talk to you about, right? Like it's just a habit.
Yeah.
So cultural humility is like slowing that down and actually maybe saving yourself a bit of time. Say, I got 5 minutes. I'm going to go ask Suta how she's doing for real.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Right?
Yeah.
That's cultural humility, in my opinion, is taking the time to really find out how you're doing.
Right. It's getting around the small talk of like, oh, weather's great today, right? It's cold. Yeah. I mean, we still do that. I still do. I think we opened up the podcast like that. But that's our communicative scripting. That's how we're taught to talk to each other. And we all fulfill the script. And it's up to us to break that in the moment and go a little bit deeper and actually show the other person that we do care how they're doing.
Right.
We do care how you've been.
Right. I'll like ask for updates on something that someone told me earlier is how I ask now, instead of just this generic, how you doing? I'll be like, so how's the new car you bought? Or how is that, you know, like I'll ask about a detail from our previous conversation because I'm actually listening now. Mm. As someone who's been through the training so many times, I do actually pay attention more to what people are saying to me, even though they might be like super busy or like distracted by something. I'll always pay attention. I'll be like, that's cool. And then the next time I see them, I'll maybe ask for an update or go back to that. That's just how I've learned to communicate now on a more effective and like personal level. And people are always like, wow, you were paying attention. I'm like, yeah, right. I was.
Right. And that's the tool. The tool is that invisible thing that makes you go, I'm going to go a little bit farther. I'm going to go a little bit extra. It's not a concept. That's actual muscle in your brain and in your heart. And I have no scientific evidence or proof of this happening, but cultural humility allows a muscle in your body, in your brain, and in your heart to flex, and it gets stronger and it gets easier to use. And so cultural humility is primarily taking employees through activities that encourage dialogue. Imagine what your workplace would be like if all of your coworkers were trained in how to talk to each other.
Imagine if people did that in high schools and began it early in life is what I think about, right? Because you see young people sometimes unable to truly communicate with each other, especially with this digital environment. Like I remember being a young kid and we had to like talk to each other. There was no texting under the table or messaging. It's like, if you wanted to say something, you had to go and actually say it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a skill that has kind of been lost, in my opinion.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because we're taught to keep your mouth shut, sit tight, just be uncomfortable, get through it, pull up the bootstraps. What other euphemisms do we have?
Oh, too many.
Turn the other cheek. You know, there's a lot of references to just being a cog in the system because that's what workforces used to be like. You used to be replaceable. You used to be just a cog in the system. But you're a person. You're a person with a spirit. You're a person with a purpose. You're a person with dreams and goals that probably don't align with the job that you're in. Very few people are lucky like we are to get to do what we want to do.
Absolutely.
And it's not lucky. I worked really hard to get here. I put a lot of training into my hydrology and water resource background. I've read way more papers than I need to on certain topics. Like, it just exhausts me thinking about it. And I've put a lot of thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of training into my skills to deliver these things. And so I was a shy girl who couldn't get up and talk in front of people. Here I am. I was a shy girl who was poor, who couldn't even steal a piece of candy from the candy store because I was so worried about the impact that it would have on the granny and then my reputation tarnishing me forever, you know, as a thief and falling into the stereotype. And knowing, like, when I went into stores in Cut Bank and all of these off reservation towns, that they do treat me like a thief. And so I was a, you know, that time in my life when I was about to make it true. And it's just, it takes all of these things that you are, you critically reflect about who you are as a person, your values, the values you were taught from your community and your family or the people you grew up with. And then if those are values that we as a population should really be carrying forward, do they bring more love into our community? Do they bring more love into your individual reality?
Yes, I love it.
So yeah, setting the stage. So we work really hard with teaching the facilitators how to set the stage. And we have a really great curriculum to facilitate these dialogues. And there's a lot that one has to do to introduce cultural humility into their organization. You have to prepare for the dialogue, which is written out in a beautiful way in the facilitator's guide. You set the stage and your foundations, and you provide the tool, which are in these activities and the guidebook. And then you communicate all these essentials and facilitate these activities in an ongoing way. But I want to hear another definition.
I love this one. It's from Maria. And again, I don't remember which cohort she's from, but I like this definition because it's something that I really embraced since becoming a facilitator. Is cultural humility is taking the time to realize that our cultural and intersectional differences should bring us together, not divide us further. The struggles of our ancestors contain great wisdom, and we have much to learn from them and from each other. Celebrating our differences, as well as what cultural ties we have in common, may be a great beginning to developing compassion and true understanding for one another. And then she writes, please check out the definition of intersectionality by Kimberly Crenshaw. And that is where I really embraced intersectionality, and it really became, it all made sense as soon as I applied that another layer of the framework on. And I was like, yes, the intersectionality is truly where the magic is, in my opinion, because I was not relating to a lot of things out there, a lot of, like, the whole feminist theory of, you know, there wasn't enough intersectionality. And once I learned and educated about Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality, it all made sense. Like, there was just so many dynamics and avenues that we're carrying. And we can't just assume that we're all experiencing the same thing the same way, because there's too many intersections. There's too many backgrounds. There's too many different lives lived. Like, even me and my cousins, we all have different, very different life experiences because of the intersectionality of it all. So that was Maria's definition of cultural humility. And I do recommend you check out the Kimberly Crenshaw talk on intersectionality on YouTube if you haven't already, because it is great.
I love her definition, and that it acknowledges the differences and that those should be celebrated. Absolutely. Because yes, there is no Indigenous value model that I've come across. So I can't find it in Blackfoot. You can tell me what you've found for the Anishinaabe. But, like, what I see generalized across other Indigenous cultures is that nobody's celebrating us all being the same and getting the same thing. It doesn't happen in the animal kingdom. It doesn't happen anywhere. All of our stories, all of our origin stories, have a special purpose attached to a unique beauty. And those are, like, really cool stories, like how raven's feathers turned black, and then we have all of the bird stories, how all of the birds got their colors, how the butterflies got their colors, how the animals got spots or stripes. We celebrate in Indigenous cultures, we're celebrating diversity and unique things of beauty that are only beautiful for those species. They wouldn't be beautiful on us, but it's gorgeous for them, right? That becomes our community construct of beauty. So now take that beautiful world and put somebody who's like really open and inclusive and like is this modern liberal person and who says, I see no color. We're one race.
So drab. Like, right? How I that just breaks my heart whenever I hear someone say that. I'm like, what a way to live.
What a violent, like the peace that you're trying to bring into the world with that statement is actually really violent because you strip everything of its unique purpose, its beauty, its place, its stories, its songs, how we relate to it, how we mimic it in dances, like the Hopis have butterfly dances that are just so beautiful. And we celebrate those things as Indigenous people. And so like when you see a friend with red hair, you find the beauty in it. And it has happened at one point. And either that's through desperation or violence where we've turned into a society where if you see something with something else that you don't have, then you feel jealousy.
Which
you
is,
don't, yeah, it's
the
toxic.
Core of that is like insecurity, is that core or the root of that feeling.
Right. So we're living in a society right now where if you see somebody with something different, you think about what you don't have and how they're better, different, more well off, must be nice type of things. Like that's how a native admits jealousy. I saw that meme going around the other day. So true. Must be nice. But like, you know, be happy for people in how they look, what they do, how they choose to express themselves. Who are you to judge and say anything? Like, you know, I'm going to dress nice and I don't necessarily feel the need to say, you know, I grew up poor. I kind of get a lot of giggles off of going to an area and having the assumptions that I'm wealthy walking in. It's fun. They don't even know how many student loans I have.
Right? Like you have no idea my debt. My debt is not a joke.
Right? And Native people don't get free education in this country, which it was supposed to be a treaty, right? Education, healthcare. There's one other thing, hunting and harvesting. Are those. And so no, natives don't get free anything. My school was almost shut down a lot as a child, and we would have had to been bused by half an hour away to the next school. So,
wow.
Yeah. And those are because of standardized testing grades, which we, you know, native communities are traditionally not standardized test takers. It works with a different side of our brain. We're creative communities. So
yeah,
culture, again, humility, right?
We're too unique. Like we're so unique. And I love the essence of that. And like the differences that Maria pointed out should be celebrated, because that's truly where inspiration comes from. And the feeling of being inspired is really important to me. That's pretty much how I get through a lot of the heaviness of the world, is I constantly look for inspiration and things that are totally new and different. And that's what needs to be celebrated in life, because we were inspired by animals and plants and, you know, everything around us. It truly creates inspiration. And that's a really important value in my life as I go through everything, is like, I need to make sure that I am inspired often in order for me to function as a creative person and just as a well-rounded, healthier being, or that I'm trying to be anyways. I have one more definition. This one's from Marianne. I remember Marianne. She was from, I think, Phoenix
Germany.
Area.
Oh, Phoenix.
Remember Marianne Ozum Wells?
Yes.
Yes, she was non-binary. She was white, and she was very like, I know. She was really, really cool. She was really aware of herself and her power, and at the same time, humble about it. So she had a few definitions. So we'll start off with this one. Cultural humility is the recognition that, given my incompetence in understanding the motivations and nuances in my own culture, it is presumptuous and entitled to think that I could ever be competent in another person's or population's culture. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Cultural humility is the recognition that I will never graduate from this path of critical self-reflection and lifelong learning. Cultural humility is willingness to be living atonement for the actions of my ancestors and a living model of accountability for my descendants. These positions demand that I neither assume the self-righteous role of quote-unquote white savior, nor collapse into the familiar inaction of quote-unquote white guilt. Cultural humility requires me to only speak on behalf of those with lived experience other than my own when they are not at the table, and then only to ask, why are they not at the table? That's good looking out, I think.
Wow.
Cultural humility looks back at the path I've been on towards social justice for over 40 years, acknowledging some forward movement and recognizing places where I could have done better, and then looks at the road ahead saying, I'm not even close to where I need to be, but I must keep moving forward. That's a lot.
Wow. Wow, that's a whole journey. I want to see a book become I feel like that was a more powerful opening than Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility.
Yeah. Marianne killed it with this definition. I can tell that she really did take the time to reflect and really process everything and present it on in a really positive and humble way. And in a funny way, I remember her character. She was funny too.
Mm-hmm. And what a great, because I'm always, we talk about code switching every now and then, you know, for
Yes.
safety and in assumptions, but what, you know, it kind of blew my mind a little bit that there, and it's so obvious, but it's not my framework, right? I had no idea until Mary framed it like that, that there are white women out there walking this fragile line, similar to mine, of white savior and what was her term?
White guilt.
White guilt. Yeah. Cause that's, I guess fragility is that first step and then guilt is the next step and then freezing or flight.
The paralysis. Yeah. The frozen in guilt, right? A lot of women are, they don't want to speak up. They're afraid to because.
Well, I'm a good person.
Right.
Yeah.
We all want to be good people.
Yeah, but we're not. And it's okay to like we're not 100% good people 100% of the time because we have off days. We are not 100% all the time and we don't know everything about everybody. And so it's not, and here's another cultural humility gem, it's not if a disagreement happens, it's when a disagreement happens and how to navigate around that disagreement. Because in cultural humility, because it was designed by two pediatricians, we use oops and ouch, right? And so when it happens, I want to be able to pull back, recognize my impact, not shame or blame the person who is feeling whatever they're feeling. They could be feeling anger. They could be feeling hate towards me. They could be feeling sadness. They could be feeling shock. Maybe something I said shocked them, right? We're not supposed to blame people for how they feel and how they deliver that feeling. That's cultural humility. Like you can't insult or hurt somebody and then expect them to calmly tell you what you did. Like if somebody comes up to you and they're crying and they can't get it together and they're so angry, sit with them until they can try to be calm, because sometimes that's scary, right? Like if somebody comes at me like that, I usually, my first instinct is to run away to protect myself. But it's really important that we do try to hear whatever it is they're saying, because, you know, we're emotional beings. And if I'm happy or if I'm angry, like there's tears still, right? Like that's just what happens when I reach that level of emotion. Yeah, cultural humility is meeting a person and realizing that you can't assume anything.
Anything. And that is a hard thing for me to wrap my head around sometimes, depending on the state that I'm in. I really have to check myself over and over again, even after a few years of doing this. Mm-hmm. My definition is really trying to experience the essence of another person peacefully as possible in a regulated state, to really experience another person. I think that's the key to our existence, is being open and humble enough to approach someone and just experience their essence, like their soul or their spirit. That's what cultural humility is for me.
Wow. That's beautiful. I really like that because it brings it down. It strips away all of that what you see, right?
Right. And what they could be going through. I'm just totally open to their world, whatever they're experiencing. Like, give it to me.
Well, that's really not judging a book by its cover and the packaging and all the assumptions that come with body weight, size, clothing, class, socioeconomic status, like getting
Yeah.
your clothes at Goodwill or Nordstrom's.
There's so much to learn from other people, and I've learned so much from different types of people throughout my life, and I see it as such a blessing. Again, it's where I draw the inspiration from, learning so many different things about people and cultures and all the subcultures and just all the experiences and life journeys people have taken to me. That's like one of my favorite things is learning about someone else and what they've gone through or where they're headed or what inspires them. It's just really cool. So cultural humility just kind of naturally fit with that. And I was like, yes, this is an even better way to approach someone and just experience people, even randomly. When you have those like 2 minute meetups with random strangers and just share a couple minutes, like they can be super beautiful as well. And they have been over the years. And of course, even when there's like a conflict or maybe there's like a weird vibe in the air, at the same time, I'm still like, okay, this is going to be maybe a challenging moment, but like, what am I going to learn from it? What can I take away from it at in the end is what I'm really searching for.
So at the field trip we did this past summer, we were talking about narrative and indigenous narratives and Métis narratives and then the settler narrative that was being found on the land. And so Harley, the president of the IV board, he when we got out to the field, he kind of walked over to the bushes and started collecting some sticks and was breaking them up with his hands into similar sizes. And I thought it was kind of like a, just a busy thing. But then I handed it over to him to say a few words, and he laid those sticks down on the ground. And he put them into a W position. And he told everybody who we were speaking to in the field trip, like, what do you see? And they said, we see an M. And I'm like, he said, well, this is a W because we're standing on separate sides of it, right? And that's the way I approach the mapping work is that I don't accept any one like past sources or elders. Single map, because I know better than that. They got their information from their grandpa or their pops or their mom and their uncle, and they have a band memory. There's four bands of Blackfoot. We have a huge territory. It's not possible for any one of us to know exactly all of it, but there were significant people in each band that knew a significant section of each because each of those bands were placed in one of those places. So I like to remind people that those old Blackfoot maps are just like band memory maps, and those are good for, but they don't represent all of our territory. And if we used any of those old maps to say this is Blackfoot territory, then you cut off all of Helena, Bozeman, Idaho, Missoula. Yellowstone sites. Those are thousands of sites that are distinctly Blackfoot. And we just, by sharing an old map, we remove ourselves from them. And so that had to stop. And so with Harley's W or M sticks on the ground, I want to add one more in for culture humility, right? So we can put an M on the ground, but our class would see a W. But then let's stick one straight up into the mud. And you could be the person seeing the M, or you could be the person seeing the W, or you could be the person saying, I see neither, we're all sticks. And you're just like the stick standing straight up in the mud. I really enjoy that. That second description of cultural humility the most is because I think that that really bothers me a lot. And then you for cultural humility, you have to think about what bothers you and why. And so what's bothering me is really when people say, I see no color and we're all one race. Why are we fighting? That bothers me because then you're wiping out all the beauty and interesting things in this world. Only because of the fear that people put into us to be different and hate and have insecurity because of that. Because if somebody else has something pretty, that means I have less. That's not a good way to live, and that's not a good thing to teach. And I hope that all of the women my age, because we used to be kids, now we're women with children, that we are teaching our children and our grandchildren that because somebody has something pretty doesn't mean that you have less. Because they have something of beauty doesn't mean that you don't have something of beauty yourself. You know, we all have our each unique individual, they're not even ideas, they're just things of beauty that we just drag around. Like there's that really great article that unpacking the white privilege knapsack, unpacking that. And so like we have invisible knapsacks that we all carry with us. And when we unpack those, we find a lot of beautiful things, especially things that I would love to save from your grandparents migrating over in the mid 1800s, say they were Irish or Romanian or Jewish or something like ethnic that was not an accepted form of white. So they dropped the portions of their names that made them ethnic. They dropped the clothing identifiers. They changed major cultural identifiers on them, changed names, bleached skin, changed hair color, all these things to like a Eurocentric white define themselves for safety.
Right.
Some of the things that have survived is that one recipe from Europe that's only shared like during the holidays, and that's all they've been able to hang on to. Well, like hang on to that and grow it, because that was the beauty you came from, and this world is going to be that less beautiful with that cultural hue missing.
Absolutely.
I think that, yeah, culture is so vibrant and so diverse because it's our challenge to each other and to ourselves of if we can walk in this world in love or if we walk in this world in like toxic jealousy.
Yes. Join us in January if you would like to develop your own sense of defining what cultural humility is to you. If you want to start the journey where our next cohort meets on January 23rd, Tuesdays and Wednesdays for the next 2 weeks for like 2.5 hours a day, 8 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Pacific time. And we will go over all of this with you. You can cultivate your own journey and definition. And if you can't make that date, we're doing it again in May, starting on May 7th. So there's a couple of opportunities to join our specific cultural humility training so that you can define it for yourself and eventually contribute it to the world around you and everybody that you interact with, because that is truly how we spread it. And that's my personal way of like impacting this world in a positive way. So hopefully you can join us.
Hope to see you there. Thank you, Melissa, for walking on this road with me.
Likewise. Thanks for listening to the Ivy Podcast. It means so much to have you here with us. If you would like to go a little bit further with your love, you can always like, share, and leave a review. It does help the podcast grow. And like I mentioned in the podcast, we do have a cultural humility training coming up this January 2024. It begins on the 23rd. I have shared the link in the show notes for this episode. Thank you, and make sure you check out our website if you'd like to learn more about us. At indigenousvision.org. We're also on Facebook and on Instagram at Indigenous Vision Media. I hope you have a wonderful day, and we'll be back very soon.